Well, good morning. The Conference Committee on Senate File 5 will now be in order. Today's date is Thursday, May 14th, 2015, and what a full house we have for our Conference Committee. And let's all admit, we know we don't have a budget target, and so really the reason why we decided to call a meeting not having a budget target is once we get that target, we are going to be under a very shortened time scenario to put the bill together. And so we wanted to have the chance for people who wanted to tell us what they thought, what was important to them, what they liked, what they didn't like, to have a chance. We don't know how much time there's going to be once we have an actual budget target. And so I do appreciate this room is very compressed, and not everybody gets a seat, but it looks like there's still a few in the middle. You could pull a chair around. We hate our press. Ms. Sturdivant is here. She doesn't have a chair. You can take a chair. Holy, just pull a chair around for her. Anyway, so the idea today is twofold. One, there are provisions in the Senate bill that the House did not have, and we wanted to give those who advocate on behalf of those provisions a chance to share those provisions with the House members so that the House members could ask any questions, and then to open it up after that to public testimony. We may not get through everybody who wants to testify at this time as the House goes into session at 10. So if we have to, we'll reconvene at another time, and we'll keep you posted as to that. So for now, we're going to begin with the Minnesota Statewide Attainment Goals. And when we went through the side-by-sides, I spent a great deal of time talking about the performance metrics. And I said how those metrics really roll up to the broader important attainment goals. Sure, Ms. Hegart, you can come to the table. And that those attainment goals were a result of the North Star Summit, as well as other work that the Citizens League and other affiliated organizations put together. And so I wanted to have a chance to give Susan Hegart from the Lumina Foundation. And Susan was the first one who kept coming into my office saying, you have to have attainment goals. And then when we had the North Star Summit, we didn't have the kind of goals that she still thought we should have. And so she came back at it. And so her tenacious persistence has paid off. And it is in the Senate provision. And so I wanted you to have a chance to communicate why you think that's so important. And then I know in public testimony we'll be having others speak on behalf of that as well.
Madam Chair and members, it's great to be here. And I want to just be clear that when I was persistent.
Introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Susan Hegart. And I currently work through a policy consulting group out of Washington, D.C. Called HCM. But I'm an advisor for the Lumina Foundation in Minnesota and in Wisconsin. I think what's really important to also understand is because I work as an advisor for the Lumina Foundation, we cannot endorse or oppose any particular legislation. So my role here is just to provide an overview, and if you have specific questions, I'd be happy to respond to those. And what I would add, Senator Bonhoff, is that in my persistence, I was trying to educate and not influence. And so I apologize
if I was not clear on the record.
So it's been a long time since I've been up here, and some of you may remember me. I worked for Governor Pawlenty, and I was the first appointed director, now commissioner, of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and I worked for him for about 7 years, about four or five in that particular role. And but I would say my most important training has been as a parent of teenagers, which I am now. And so I wish that I'd had that training in the days before when I worked up here much of the time. It's a humbling experience. So attainment goal. I'm going to first speak to that, and then Senator Bonhoff, if you'd like me to talk more about the performance metrics, I can do that too. So what is an attainment goal? An attainment goal and completion goal, attainment and completion are terms that are commonly used interchangeably, but they really don't mean the same thing. They're related, but they're different. Attainment refers to the educational level, which means a credential or degree, of a state's population, while a completion goal speaks to a particular credential, And comparison of students enrolled at an institution or groups of institutions or a system. So for MNSCU, for example, or the U of M, you would have a completion goal, for example, that's pertinent to them. But an attainment goal would be at a state level. So I just want to be very clear about that. They're not the same, but they are related. What does a credential mean? I think a lot of times people get confused. They think, well, a degree means a four-year degree. That's not at all what we're talking about. So a credential means a certificate, a two-year, a four-year degree and beyond, anything beyond a high school diploma. So I want to be clear about that definition as well. Completion goals for the system or for the institution hopefully align with the targeted state attainment goal. So the Lumina Foundation, which you may or may not have heard of, they're in Indianapolis, and they have a very keen focus on higher education policy. And their overall goal is by 2025, 60% of the United States population will have a credential beyond high school. So a credential means a certificate, two-year, four-year degree, or more. So in Minnesota, right now, we're at about 48%. That includes unemployed and employed people. And that number excludes certificates and students who've had some college but don't have a degree. So if you added in, for example, certificates and some college, no degree, our number would be closer to about 60%. One of the things I wanted to draw your attention to, and I've got a few extra copies if there are people here who want them. You can also pull them down from the website. Is I've got a list here for you of all the states that happen to have attainment goals, and I think what's interesting is you'll see a very broad mix of states. Many of them are lean red or are red. Many of them lean blue or are blue, and many are in the middle. So I think it's just illustrative to kind of take a look at this and see what the various state goals are. They've decided them, and all of these goals have to either be established by the legislature, a governor, a governing board, and that sort of thing. They have to be statewide. So they're bottom-up and they're state level. So why is an attainment goal important? Well, if you don't know where you're going, any road is going to get you there. So an attainment goal enables a state to focus on its key priorities, what's particular to that state, and serve as a roadmap for leaders like you at the state system and institution level to set priorities, develop policies and programs, and identify funding, and measure progress over time to effectively manage public and taxpayer investment. There's an accountability aspect to this. What's important for an attainment goal is that it be quantifiable so that you can measure it, that it address an achievement gap, that it include a target date, that it be articulate, as I mentioned, in state statute, or state strategic plan and have broad stakeholder input. So I think if you take a look at the legislation or the goal that's been drafted before you, those elements that I've noted are present in that particular...
Excuse me, we're just going to pull that chair aside for Senator Stump. And Commissioner Pogemiller, there's a chair over on the side. Over here. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. So again, what's important about an attainment goal is that you can measure it, that it's quantifiable, it addresses achievement gaps, that it included a target date in state statute or in a state strategic plan and have broad stakeholder input. And if you look at the goal that's before you, those elements appear to be present in that draft. One of the important things to remember is that Minnesotans and our country can't be successful unless all and not just some people have an opportunity to be able to earn a meaningful credential beyond a high school diploma. That's not that there's a guarantee, but they have a chance to do that.
And sorry to interrupt you one other time. I just want members to know the Minnesota statewide attainment goal that's in our packet is on page R64, line 53.3. You don't need to know that, but I'm just letting you know. Go ahead.
You know, there are many ways right now underway to try and boost achievement for students, particularly those who are struggling, but it's really hard to understand which ones are working, how to scale them, and that sort of thing. So one of the things I think that's useful about having a very high-level attainment goal is that you can look at evidence, figure out what works, and then measure your progress over time. And I think the fact that the Office of Higher Education has a robust, you know, and effective data system allows you all to have confidence that measuring can occur. So what are some of the strategies that people around the country have tried to boost attainment? You know, one of course that's obvious is remediation. Are there approaches to remediation that can be taken that allow students not to be repeating courses over and over, but to actually earn credit and move through to earn some type of a credential or degree? There was a very interesting example of this in California. Jolene Kester, who was the president of Cal State Northridge, spoke to this at the Citizens League meeting. And what was really interesting about her approach is she's originally from Minnesota, went to college here, and then became the president of Cal State Northridge. And what she did, without, as you know, the situation in California, any additional revenue over a period of about 3 years, she boosted graduation rates at her institution remarkably. And her institution serves very low-income students, very challenged students. And what she did is she implemented a policy of intensive advising all the way across and through her institution. So they had early warning flags and early intervention to try to let students know, for example, what's the impact when you drop a class? Are you going to lose your financial aid? What happens if you do that in terms of your being on track to complete your major on time? And so she was very, very successful, and there's much information about her available. So as I mentioned, how many states have goals? There are 31 states that have them. There are that's more states than are listed on this handout. These states include the ones that have statewide attainment goals. And the other states that are not listed probably just have one for their system in particular. How does an attainment goal connect with the state's economy? So the data, for the people who are economists, and I will tell you I am not an economist. If you want an economist, I'm sure that there is someone in the room who is one. But there are data sets that are particular to looking at demand for jobs in the industries. And there's data that looks at certificates and credentials and that sort of thing. So what's really important, though, is the data, and this is from the American Community Survey out of the census, is that the more education a person has, the better chance they're able to earn a living, to support themselves, and to support a family. So, for example, with a 2- or 4-year degree, a person can earn an average of about $50,000 a year. With a certificate, they can earn about $32,000 a year, and with a high school diploma, $27,000 a year. So you can see there are differences in the ability in a person's earnings depending upon the levels of education that they have over their lifetime. One estimate is out there is that in order to meet the goal of 60% by 2025 in Minnesota, we would need an additional 134,000 additional college-educated adults. And again, that's credential, not a 4-year degree. So that's across the spectrum. And that data comes out of NCHEMS, which is a data organization in Denver, Colorado.
I'm missing. I'm going to have to wrap up.
Yeah. So just quickly, there are employer groups that are developing some interesting ways to better match supply and demand. And I think if you have questions about that, you could certainly ask them. I also think that if you're looking at the demographic change that Minnesota is facing, it's very, very important to think about how that population will be better educated, because you're not going to be able to get there. We're not going to be able to get there without trying to figure out how to improve their educational experience as well. So one thing just in closing I wanted to say is that diversity doesn't mean just students who don't look like me. It also means older students. It also means students who may live in rural areas, so it's really important to be open-minded when thinking about that. And then finally, my understanding is that the U.S. Census is planning to collect certificate information in a meaningful way next year. I know our Office of Higher Education is working on that too, so there will be a much better way of rolling those numbers up. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions and step out of the way for others. Thank you,
Ms. Heard. Thank you so much for being here, and my hope is that if members do have questions, that you could follow up as well. But if there are any questions that you'd like to ask now, I should give you the opportunity. So any questions for the members? You sure you don't want to just have one burning one? Representative Koenig.
Susan, and my last name is Hegard.
Thanks for your testimony. I have been to our college in my area.
Bonoff and Representative Grunhagen. So thank you. So I'd say a couple things. One is that culturally, I think that you'll find around the country that the community colleges and the tech colleges have a very close relationship because they serve their communities in general with the businesses and the employers in their communities. So that relationship is sort of there, and they do a good job of making sure that they're serving the needs of their community. I think it's been challenging for your institutions, for example, to do that in the same way. Although I think that in particular fields, you'll find very close relationships with industry. So I think this provides an opportunity for all institutions and all providers of education, public and private, to pay attention to the demands of the workforce and of the employers around the state. So that's one part answer to your question. The other, I think, is that I think they are trying to pay better attention. There's better data now. I think there's work still to do, but I think with the availability of data, with having a high-level goal and with the availability of better data, and you know, members like you asking tough questions, I think things are improving. I mean, the debt information is out there, and people are really worried about it.
One other thing I would just mention is, you know, we in the Senate have this Senate rule that we're not allowed to impugn another member's motives. And so while we may not be able to stand here and say what are the motives of, you know, remediation or anything like that, I think what we can do is set bold goals and objectives. And that's why we have the attainment goals, and that's why our performance metrics are designed to reduce debt, increase completion. And so, again, while we wouldn't disparage our institutions, we're certainly being clear about where we stand. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
So the next proposal that we were going to take testimony on is the University of Minnesota Medical School. And Dr. Jackson's not able to join us, but we are very fortunate to have Dr. Labine. Did I say that correctly? But is it correct?
Labine,
thank you. And so just to remind the members, the Senate bill has proposed an investment in the University of Minnesota Med School aligned with the Blue Ribbon Commission of the Governors for $25 million. The governor had proposed an investment of $30 million. And so we'd only like to have just a few minutes because of the compressed time frame, but if you could speak to your vision and the way those resources would be put to work and why they're important.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, my name is Tucker Labian. I'm Vice Dean for Research at the Medical School, Associate Vice President for Research at the Academic Health Center. I directed my own research laboratory on human blood cell development and leukemia for 30 years before assuming these positions. So a state investment in medical discovery teams will clearly enhance the medical school's national preeminence by attracting and retaining faculty who do some of the most innovative and cutting-edge research in the world, and will also attract the best students to Minnesota, both undergraduate students, graduate students, and fellows who train in specific clinical departments. But more importantly, on a long-term basis, this initiative will ultimately impact the healthy lives of the citizens of the state of Minnesota, which is the core purpose for which we exist in the medical school and conduct research. I think many of you know we have a rich tradition of accomplishment in organ transplantation, blood and marrow transplantation. These accomplishments have given new life to citizens in this state, citizens around the country and the world. We've attracted students to join us on this journey who want to be part of such exciting research. And, of course, there's been economic returns through external research funding as well as technology transfer. So I just want to give one vignette that I think some of you are familiar with that really, I think, drives home the significance of medical discovery teams. So I think some of you know one of my close friends and colleagues, Dr. Jacob Tolar, who has been down here and testified before you. He's the director of our Stem Cell Institute. He conducts research in blood and marrow transplantation, but really the defining element of his portfolio of accomplishments in the last few years has been to have the courage with he and his colleagues to transplant patients with a catastrophic skin disease called epidermolysis bullosa. And Dr. Tolar and his colleagues see families and children with this disease in their clinics at Masonic Children's Hospital. And the way that we tackle problems like this at the university is that individuals like Dr. Tolar build relationships with other colleagues in dermatology, genetic engineering, cell therapy, et cetera, to develop the best ways to treat these individuals. And we've had some, they have had some remarkable success stories that are now receiving worldwide attention. So I would use Dr. Tolar's example, and it's only one, as my rationale and justification for seeing, for justifying why we need to invest and create more medical discovery teams like Dr. Tolar's. And I'll stop there, and I'd be pleased to take any questions.
So any questions? Now is your time to ask how those resources would be used, or any questions you may have about this proposal. Well, thank you very much for being here.
It's not supposed to be this easy.
You know, I think in many ways your great research does stand for people understand the importance of it. And so it is my belief that the House not having it be in their proposal was more a function of target than not understanding how important it is. But perhaps you would like to speak to that.
Finances is basically for us.
Yes.
One comment. I know through a bout of leukemia that I had a few years ago, one of the things I appreciated was the ability of my doctor to go to the university and so talk to some experts. I think that's one of the things that we're missing many times. The public doesn't know, but that collaboration that occurs, there really is a benefit to your people. So I greatly appreciate your work and the ability for our physicians locally to reach out to you. So.
Well, thank you for those comments, Senator Clausen. That really defines the relationship between community oncology throughout the state and oncologists at the university. This is a team effort. We pull in the same direction, and we're totally committed to this process.
And we've received a letter from the Mayo Clinic underscoring their commitment and hope that we are able to support you in this way, because they have identified how important your work is to their combined mission.
That's terrific. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And Senator Nelson, on that same subject, has a provision within the Senate bill to support the Alzheimer research. And Senator Nelson has a much broader proposal this session regarding Alzheimer's, but the piece that's in the higher ed bill is very defined, and she's going to just let you know about that.
Thank you, Chair Bonoff, Chair Nordis, committee members. It's very good to be with you this morning, and I know your time is really tight. So let me just elaborate briefly on Chair Bonoff's comments about Senate File 247, which is a comprehensive Alzheimer's proposal. And as Chair Bonoff said, one piece of that proposal is before you today in the conference committee, and that is the Senate language on R29 regarding funding for Alzheimer's research. And that's what I'll talk about today. But I also want to let you know that the dementia grants part of the proposal, which is the hands-on, feet in the ground, connecting caregivers to resources and encouraging early cognitive testing, that part of the Alzheimer's proposal is in the Health and Human Services and Housing Omnibus Bill. And thank you, House members, for including that provision in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. So it's my hope at the end of the day that the House language will prevail regarding dementia grants over an HHH, and in the Higher Ed Committee today, the Senate language will prevail in funding the Alzheimer's research grants. And I'd like to tell you briefly about why those grants are so important. Just to give you a little background on the incidence, I know we're all familiar with Alzheimer's, some more intimately than others, but 1 in 9 will have Alzheimer's by the age of 65. And by the age of 83, it will be 85, it will be 1 in 3 who have Alzheimer's. And the incidence is significant when you consider our aging population. Over 10,000 baby boomers today turn 65. And tomorrow, another 10,000 will turn 65. And for each and every day, for the next 19 years, another 10,000 Americans are going to hit 65, where that incidence of Alzheimer's increases dramatically. In fact, in Minnesota, every 67 seconds, while I'm speaking right here, we have one Minnesotan who is diagnosed with Alzheimer's. It's significant, members. And the prevalence is going to increase in Minnesota by 36% in the next 10 years. It is a crisis, members. And the total health care costs for a patient with Alzheimer's is three times, 300% more than the cost for a patient without Alzheimer's. Now, while we have seen remarkable things in our society when we have put our collective minds to finding a cure. For example, in the last 10 years, we have seen the incidence of breast cancer decline by 2%. We have seen prostate cancer decline by 8%. We have seen heart disease decline by 16%, stroke by 23%, and HIV by 42%. Alzheimer's is the exception. The incidence in the last 10 years has increased by over 68%. So, members, we know that this has great personal cost to us. Many of us have experienced that. I did hand you a brief outline or a brief packet, and I'll just briefly draw your attention to the first page, the goldenrod page, which shows a map of our great state. And I'm sorry it's in black and white because it doesn't do justice to the color. But basically, what I'd like you to notice is the incidence of Alzheimer's is most likely greater in our rural parts of the state. And as you look at this map, it shows the median age by years. And you will notice that the darker colors are the older median ages. And most of those are in our rural communities, while the more urbanized metro area is basically a younger population with median age of 36. But the darker areas have a median age of 46 or over. So it is regionally even more problematic in our rural areas. And incidentally, those areas oftentimes have fewer resources to help family and caregivers deal with their loved ones who have Alzheimer's. So the incidence is great. The cost is going to escalate. And as policymakers, the reason that we should be concerned is that 68%. More than two-thirds of the cost of Alzheimer's is paid for through Medicare and Medicaid. So not only is it a personal issue and an issue of great emotional cost to families and communities, members, it is a great cost to the public purse. It is a great concern for financial decisions in the state of Minnesota. And just to give you a little national perspective, we're not alone in this. In fact, in 2014, nationally, the costs of Alzheimer's were $226 billion. That's billion with a B. Now, in the next 35 years, members, that cost is going to skyrocket to $800 billion. And remember, the taxpayers pay more than two-thirds of that cost. And that's why the proposal before you today is so important. We can lead. Minnesota can lead in Alzheimer's research. In fact, this body in 2009 realized the importance of Alzheimer's and getting the data and the numbers to understand this devastating disease. And that's why the Minnesota legislature formed the Alzheimer's Working Group in 2009. And in 2011, they put out this wonderful report, Preparing Minnesota for Alzheimer's, the Budgetary, Social, and Personal Impacts. And in your packet, I have given the blue sheet to you, which just specifically states that number seven, one of the main goals of this Preparing Minnesota for Alzheimer's is specifically continue aggressive research for prevention, treatment, and cure for Alzheimer's. And members...
Excuse me one moment.
Yes.
Senator Nelson, so in your bill before you, the on Alzheimer's, if members want to take a look at it, is R29, like 25.33.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be glad to do so. And I can conclude with the fact that Minnesota can lead, and it has led. We have internationally recognized Alzheimer's disease research centers like Mayo Clinic, the University of Minnesota, and our research structure, our infrastructure is already in place. Members, we have made impacts on decreasing incidence of various diseases, and I am sure that Minnesota can do it again. It is only through research that we will change the trajectory that we spoke of this morning. And members, as I'm sure you can tell, it is an epidemic. Currently, 11% of Minnesotans over 65 have Alzheimer's disease. And Minnesota families are touched by Alzheimer's, and at an alarming rate. It's a public health crisis of our century, and it is the defining disease of the baby boom generation. It's been a heartbreak to watch loved ones struggle with Alzheimer's disease, and it's a pain that many of us know all too well. And as I said, in addition to the human suffering, it creates enormous strain on our healthcare systems and significant burdens on family, state, and federal budgets. So with that, Madam Chair, I thank you for your time. I'd encourage the members to further look. I just want to draw your attention to the rest of the packet. The pink paper shows a couple letters of support. ARP is supporting this initiative, as are the Minnesota Board on Aging. And finally, on the back page of the first of that yellow page, there's a letter to the editor that Senator Pappas and I wrote to the Star Trip about Alzheimer's. I just want to thank you for your time and for your consideration.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. And the way the proposal is structured within the Senate bill is to appropriate $1 million in 2016, $1 million in 2017, and this is given directly to the University of Minnesota and Mayo Foundation partnership, these research dollars.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
So, with apologies, our intention is not to talk at you, but rather there are a lot of people, as you can see, to present, and we just have a couple more provisions within our bill. We do want to have the opportunity to present, but please do interrupt at any time with questions. So, Senator Stump. And then if, Coley, if you could bring the chair over for Ms. Burgess. So we are really honored to have Senator Stump with us today. Senator Stump is our most senior member, and so it is. And of course, he's always so gracious. He's helping Ms. Burgess with her chair. But it has really been a privilege to hold the proposal within the higher ed bill that Senator Stump has put forward. And it is really an unusual and innovative proposal, and one that actually I think takes some time to understand, because at first glance, people read the headline, free college tuition for students, and balk, and think, you know, what is that? We don't do that. We do aid-based. We do or need-based. We have a different approach to higher ed. And so I thought it was important that we take the time to understand the thinking behind it, why have we put this as a centerpiece within our bill, and then really to give you a chance to ask questions. So, Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chairman. And it's a pleasure to be here. One thing I found out this morning is that the Commissioner of the Higher Education Office is in much better shape than I am. He took the stairs up, and I tried to follow him. Let me give you just a little bit of foundation for this, and it goes back about a year and a half ago when the Capital Investment Committee on the Senate side were going around the state doing their tours, looking at different projects, and almost every community that we stopped in, we talked to local government people, we talked to business people, a lot of presentations on these stops, and almost every one of them gave us the message that they were sure. this was, like I say, true across the state. So that kind of was lingering in the back of my mind for a long time, and that's definitely true in my part of the state as well. We're very fortunate. We have probably some of the lowest unemployment in the state, northwest corner. We have good manufacturers up there, Marvin Windows, Polaris, Arctic Cat, DigiKey, just a host of them that are providing jobs. In fact, in Thief River Falls, there's more jobs in Thief River Falls than there are people in the city, which is hard to believe, but they're busing people into Thief River Falls from as far away as East Grand Forks and Crookston and the surrounding area. They, too, need skilled employees. And so when actually was on the radio, I believe, where I heard what Tennessee was doing, which was, I didn't think that Tennessee was as progressive as Minnesota. So I listened, and they came up with the idea that it was a little bit structured a little differently, but came up with the idea of free two-year college tuition. So we got information from them and talked to people and looked at, did a lot of discussing, and we looked at how could we attract more people into for that post-secondary training, the two-year college kind of training that you can get at a technical college or a community college. And that's kind of the foundation of this proposal, is that there is a segment of people out there, young people in particular, that are not going on to get trained. Some of them are students that are in our alternative schools. Some of them are students that get GEDs. They come, they're immigrants, and they come into our communities. Some of them are students that haven't thought about higher education and probably would never think about higher education because, you know, a lot of their parents, they don't have a tradition or culture of higher education. And so what this tries to open up to them is that opportunity. Even though we can tell them that there's a lot of financial aid available and say, oh yeah, you can go or you can go on to post-secondary, a lot of them won't believe it. This, in talking to the young students, this does something. It has a message out there that grabs them and says, oh, it's an opportunity. So then what goes along with that opportunity is a number of things, and I'm sure you'll go through the legislation. The most important thing was, how do you get those students into the school? How do you get those students tracking and pursuing that with a certain amount of vigor? And that's where the mentorship comes in. For most of us, the mentorship was in our family. You know, like our parents say, hey, Leroy, you better get your homework done. You got a test tomorrow. But it's that kind of mentorship that a lot of these students don't have. And that's where I think the success rate found out in Tennessee, that mentorship is so important for success. And I think that the cost, definitely there's a cost, and it is a new program, but the cost, when you look at that, is about $3,500 per year for them. And over a couple of years, it's $7,000, but you can get them, if they follow the program and the success is there, to get a skilled employee out of this, a trained employee for $7,000 is really a good deal for the state and for our business community across the state. So I think that, and I won't go into the details, but I think that's the foundation that we have to kind of look at it through, is that this is going to attract in new students. It's going to be a little bit of a pressurized system for them because they have to be successful within that 2 years. There's time frames after the first year. They have to carry a certain GPA. And that mentorship is going to be there and watching them all the way along. And I think it would be important for Minnesota to try it. And I know it's precious money that you would allocate if you go down that road. But I think with the enormous shortage of skilled employees, whether it's our nursing homes or whether it's our manufacturing or whether it's our industry, every one of them are short of employees. And I think it's worth the attempt to try to get them pulled into this higher education or post-secondary education. Who knows? Some of them will go on to a four-year college or a four-year degree, but a lot of them, I think, will be those trained employees that we really need.
Senator Stump, one of the things that we've discussed is some people are concerned about a potential negative impact on the four-year state colleges, and you mentioned to me how that this actually would allow students to take those courses at the state colleges as well at universities. It doesn't just have to be in a technical school. So can you address that?
Well, the foundation of the funding is around the Carl Perkins dollars. And the Carl Perkins dollars are tied closely to the technical kinds of programs. And so that's, it is... In that area, there's programs that are not funded because they're not attached to our Perkins funding. I think in most cases, it will not pull students away from four-year institutions. I think in the language, you'll see that there is an attempt to try to get at the diversity through opening that opportunity up to people with a degree or high school diplomas that would not have been received through a traditional method. There are some other good provisions in here, and one of them is, I think, there is a rise in the amount that students can receive from the state grant program. And so I think that helps kind of a middle sector of our society that quite often kind of runs out of the, doesn't quite get there. So I think some opportunities here that would be very interesting and obviously would report back as to whether they're successful.
Ms. Fergus?
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I am the state grant analyst for the Office of Higher Education, and I help prepare the fiscal note on this program. Keeping the program description starts on page R53, line 43.3 in your side-by-side. The program is meant to serve students in the Minsky system. It is meant to serve students who are in Perkins Career and Technical Education programs as defined under federal law. It is also for specific program areas that are defined in the proposed language, leading to high-demand occupational fields. The program level is for certificates and associate degrees, so those are two-year or less level, so are shorter-term programs. And they can stay in the program for up to 72 credits to complete their program during the two-year period of eligibility. Students become eligible when they have graduated from a Minnesota high school, finished an adult basic education course, or passed the GED. That is when their two-year eligibility period starts, essentially, because they are asked to enroll in the fall term following that event. It is a last dollar in scholarship, which means that it's the cost of tuition and fees minus Pell Grant, minus state grant, minus any AmeriCorps scholarship. There is a two-year kind of waiver for AmeriCorps service members that they can actually defer their enrollment for up to 2 years as long as they are in the AmeriCorps program. In terms of how OHE would be asked to implement the program, it would be implemented as a campus-based financial childcare grants or our state work study program. The colleges would identify eligible students and initially promote the program, though OHE can take on more responsibility for that in the longer term. Just a reminder that this program is supposed to start July 1st, and there is a lot of administrative stuff to put in place. One of the challenges that we've identified is the language that was added on the Senate floor, which is on line 43.2, in that the programs must lead to an occupational field designated as high demand by deed. There is no current definition that we've identified in state law of high demand, and so we would need to create one with deed.
Ms. Fergus, could you say again where that sentence is found?
Line 43.20 on page R53. R54, sorry. It's just one of those technical things that we just encountered. We do know what a high-demand occupation is. However, linking that cleanly to their program of study is the challenge.
We'll work on that.
Yes. And that is all I have in terms of technical.
Any questions?
What does it cost to the state?
Certainly.
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and Representative Nornes. The cost to the state in the first year is $9.1 million. That cost is broken out between the actual funding of the grants and mentoring programs. The total funds would be $7.2 million in grants and $1.6 million in mentoring. For year two, the cost is $12.4 million in grants and $2.8 million in funding, for a total biennial cost of $24.4 million, and then I believe there's some additional money for administration.
With the timeline that you mentioned, would it make sense to delay the year so you try to actually prepare by what is close? I don't know how you would do that.
Madam Chair, Representative Ornes, I can say that more time is always welcome in setting up new programs.
I don't need a definite answer. It's still questions.
Any other questions? Ms. Fergus, we've done some research on the enrollment impact in Tennessee because there's been some concern that this would just rob from one bucket to another, and in fact, that's not what happened in Tennessee. Do you have those numbers?
Madam Chair, I do not.
Thomas? Could you just briefly? Thank you very much. Welcome. Introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Thomas Sanford. I work in the Office of Higher Education. Prior to my time here, I worked at the Tennessee Higher Education Commission, which is the governing board for higher education in Tennessee. It was there during the policy implementation of Tennessee Promise. Currently, they project a 12,000 to 19,000 student increase in community colleges as a result of Tennessee Promise. Some of that percentage is a shift from 4-year to 2, but they don't have specific numbers yet. This fall will be the first implementation year of the full program.
And what percent increase was that?
I don't remember the percentage. I think it's about 14 to 22,
yeah. So, good. Thank you very much. Thanks, Senator Stone.
I think we have one more Senate proposal we're going to hear about before we open up to the public testimony, and that's Representative Schultz. So although it's a Senate proposal, we're hearing from a House member. And this is on R31, line 27.4.
Thank you, Chairs Bonoff and Nornes. So I'm here representing the faculty at UMD. They're not able to testify, so I'm here to testify for them. They're giving finals this week. This is a testimony from Professor David Schimpf. He's at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He's been a faculty member, academic department head, director of a graduate program, and museum director at UMD. And he thanks you for allowing this to be read into the record for today's testimony. Most of the faculty at the University of Minnesota Duluth believe that the university's leaders have not provided satisfactory justification for the lower allocation of state O&M monies to the Duluth campus. Faculty developed this view after examining evidence. residents and participating in a few visits to the campus by system leaders
Representatives. So this is really your time as a state representative to communicate why you support the provision you authored. Public testimony would be a faculty member, and so I'd rather you just give your testimony for the members to be read. And if you could just share with the committee why you support the effort that you're putting forward as a representative. That's
so
what
can
this
you be
is
more
for.
Specific about the provision in the Senate bill? The appropriation to this the University of Minnesota system?
So no, this is the provision within the bill that Senator Reinert and I believe you authored to ask for reporting on the University of Minnesota Duluth.
I actually didn't. I didn't submit that. That was for Senator Reinert,
okay.
And he was might have been here to testify, but I can talk about that provision,
thank
and
you.
I'll just read the paragraph that
okay,
that
great.
Is relevant to that provision. So this is a provision that asks to investigate or have the University of Minnesota system report how they allocate system funding that's appropriated by the state to each campus. And I think that was an amendment that Senator Roger Reinert offered on the floor and was adopted in the Senate version.
Right.
And because there's a belief that the appropriations that have been allocated in the last few years doesn't help meet the mission of the University of Minnesota Duluth campus. And they have their state appropriation is the lowest of any four-year institution in our state. They're the second largest research university. They rank 32 out of 34 in appropriations. And so there's some concern that they're not able to meet the mission of the university given their state appropriation. And in light of that, the problem has really arisen because of decreased overall state funding to higher education. So UMD in particular is hurt at a greater degree or disproportionately than other institutions in the state. They've seen a decrease of 40% since 2009, so they've become very tuition dependent. The system as a whole has only seen a decrease of 20% since 2009. So as we were doing well at UMD, enrollment was increasing, so we became more dependent on tuition as state funding fell, but in the last few years, our enrollment has declined, similar to other institutions across the state. Although since 2004, enrollment increased 4.4%, we did experience an increase in enrollment just because of demographics. So they're feeling like their ability to meet mission can only happen if they have significant budget cuts. And so they've cut academic programs. They're contemplating cutting the honors program. And there's not a lot to cut at UMD. So it's an institution that has very low instructional costs. I think that might be a report that you have been given by Professor Schimpf. They have, I think their instructional costs are lower than Morris, Rochester, and the Twin Cities. And that's reporting from the university system on direct instructional costs, doesn't include indirects. So I really urge this conference committee to increase overall investment in higher education and leave it up to the system administrators to make sure that the allocation gets to UMD and the other campuses so they can all meet their mission. And I really thank you for your time. The other thing I just also want to mention is the funding for the medical school is really important. So I know you mentioned the Blue Ribbon Task Force, and I want to, since I represent the University of Minnesota medical school on the Duluth campus, I just want you guys to remind you guys that this is a campus that's basically the number one medical school in the country for the percentage of MDs who practice in rural areas. And this is a really need in our state to get rural practitioners. So I want to make sure that you guys do fund medical school requests because it is really a necessity to get rural practitioners in Minnesota. Thank you.
Yep, thank you very much. And we appreciated Senator Reinert's proposal because really what his request is that we as a legislature understand how the formula is allocated, and we do hear from particularly those folks from UMD on a regular basis that they're concerned they aren't getting their appropriate share of that allocation, and so information's important. So We were pleased to put it in, and that's why we wanted to make sure you had a chance to speak today. So thank you.
Thank you.
And you're welcome to distribute. Our page can make sure we get copies of your faculty members' testimony.
I think you have it already.
Good.
The packet was distributed.
Thank you
very much.
Okay, so that completes the provisions, unless there's anyone on the House side who has a provision that we don't have that would like an opportunity to speak to that, we'll move to public testimony. Chair Nornes, anything you'd like to add? Okay, very good. So starting out, Commissioner Pogemiller. And everybody, just to be respectful of time, if you can make your comments brief so we can get through as many as possible before the House is in session. And we ask Commissioner Pogemiller to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair. The Governor first wanted me to express his appreciation for the Governor's willingness to discuss higher ed issues and to make an investment this year. Also, he appreciates the openness of himself. First, he supports your commitment to tuition relief through institutional appropriations, and he supports new investment in the state grant for lower middle income students and families. He supports your work on sexual assault and campus safety, and your delineation of retention and completion strategies. Whatever your final target, and as you know, working to make it higher than both of your targets, closer to his target. But whatever the final target, he supports a balanced investment between institutional support and support directly to students in the state grant. New investment. His priorities are 1, medical research preeminence; 2, state grant; and 3, proportional and balanced amount of money to the institutions to support tuition relief. And Chairman, any questions?
That was succinct and clear. Any questions for the Commissioner? Thank you.
Thank you.
That was brief. That was very nice.
Okay, next we have President Kaler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chairman, I'm Eric Kaler, President of the University of Minnesota, and I will very briefly summarize our request, report on administrative reductions, and fill you in on some tuition data. We are, you will recall, seeking a $65.2 million increase from our current base to add to our operating and maintenance budget. That would enable us to freeze tuition for all Minnesota resident undergraduate and graduate students on all of our campuses. According to our records, there are 4,811 students who live in the districts that you represent. Freezing tuition for 4 years will save them between $2,000 and $2,500 for a total of $10 million in savings for your constituents with this tuition freeze. I believe this would help rebalance the partnership of the state and the university. Over the past 3 years, we have reallocated administrative costs to our missions of teaching, research, and public engagement by $39 million. We have a one-pager in front of you. It's a beautiful maroon and gold piece of paper. One side shows a bar graph that shows that we've reduced the number of leadership and oversight positions by 198 individuals, a reduction in that category by 11% over the past 3 years. A concern that I have heard is what we charge for tuition for out-of-state students. As you know, it's the lowest in the Big Ten, even though it remains $7,000 more than for in-state and reciprocity students. In aggregate, non-resident, non-reciprocity students are paying more than the average cost of educating a university student, and our Minnesota residents are paying somewhat less. The other side of the chart, the other side of the paper you have, shows our business model for out-of-state tuition, and you will see it is working. Prior to 2008, we charged a relatively high out-of-state tuition. You will notice the number of students who came from out-of-state and the amount of revenue they brought with them remained relatively constant. We then reduced the out-of-state tuition fairly dramatically, and that strategy worked like a charm. The number of out-of-state students has increased dramatically. The amount of revenue they bring with them has increased dramatically. And now we have been able to restore the out-of-state tuition charge to what it was before we cut it initially, of course, with adjusting for inflation. But we plan to continue that trend. You will notice the number of students is curving very slightly, indicating the onset of price elasticity. And we believe that by carefully increasing this over the coming years, we will reach the midpoint of the out-of-state tuition band for the Big Ten while maintaining the appropriate number of out-of-state students and generating a significant revenue. We do not believe it is sensible to do that in one big step. We recognize it would be highly unlikely that all of the students that we have would return. And we think that, in fact, a large increase in out-of-state tuition has the potential to reduce the total aggregate revenue from out-of-state students. But we are paying careful attention to this, and we have a plan to move that forward. With that, Madam Chair, let me close with some other news around enrollment. We're expecting to see a nearly 17% increase in incoming students from outside the Twin Cities metro area to the Twin Cities campus. So we believe our strategies are working. We believe the quality of the University of Minnesota continues to increase. We are grateful for your consideration of enhancing state support to enable us to hold tuition flat and, of course, to make the critically important investment in our medical school that you heard Dr. Levine speak about earlier. Thank you.
Questions for President
Keith. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, President Kaler. President Kaler, one more. Could you just fill us in on where we're at with regard to the human subjects testing and how that's going? We're supposed to get a report on May 15th. Can you just fill us in on
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, certainly. The Implementation Committee has been working feverishly. They have asked for an extension from the 15th, which is Friday, to the 18th, which is Monday. I have agreed to that so that they will have a full weekend of activity in completing that report. It is thorough. It is about 80 pages in its current draft form. I expect it will address the recommendations that the external panel provided and also fulfill the first recommendation of the legislative auditor's review. I remain committed to moving our human subjects activity to be above reproach, the best in the nation. And as I've said many times, I cannot do anything about the past, but I can work very hard to make the future excellent, and that's what we intend to do in this area.
President Kaler, we have language in the Senate bill that puts forward our commitment with regard to that. Does that language meet with your understanding of what's happening, and do you have any concern about that language?
Madam Chair, I believe the reporting frequency is perhaps more frequent than it actually needs to be. I don't know that we'll make that much progress on a month-to-month basis, but I'm committed to being open and transparent, and to the degree you want reporting and you want visibility, you're obviously entitled to it, and we will give it to you.
President Kaler, with regard to the change from the 15th to the 18th, the concern is we close on the 18th. And so I would ask that we be given something in the morning so that we as committee members at least have a chance to deliberate and therefore have a chance to come together if we choose to.
Madam Chair, we certainly can do that. I believe our staff has been in conversation about this, but we certainly will provide this to you. I feel an obligation to actually read it before and agree with it before I release it to the world. And so I would ask your indulgence in that, recognizing this is a group working very hard, but we will get it to you in the morning of the 18th of May.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for the members? Sometimes, you know, we've had many conversations off the record on this subject, and the Senate did do a tremendous amount of work with regard to the legislative auditor, but we haven't had much conversation publicly beyond that. So I thought it was important to ask questions on the record so the public does understand that this isn't something that we are just assuming is going on without scrutiny. And so I know that you and I know that, but it gives us a chance to make sure the public is aware as well.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Ryan Olson from the Student Association, University of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to share with you how important the outcome of the Higher Education Omnibus Bill is for University of Minnesota students. My name is Ryan Olson, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition. I represent the legislative interests of all 70,000 students from all five campuses at the University of Minnesota, including Morris, Crookston, Duluth, Rochester, and here in Twin Cities, of course, including some of the students that are here with me today in the back over there during finals week, nonetheless, so I appreciate them being here. We're here to express our strong support for increased investment in Minnesota's higher education that provides funding for a tuition freeze for all in-state students, undergraduate, professional, and graduate students. The Senate bill included funding for a large portion of this. The teachers, vets, doctors, and engineers that are trained at the University of Minnesota serve critical needs of the state, and burdening them with higher tuition levels is simply not a way to fill those voids. An investment which allows for a tuition freeze will signal to students that the state is willing to do its part to keep the cost of college from being a barrier to attaining a post-secondary degree. To move away from policy, I want to explain on a personal level why the decisions this committee makes are so important to me. To me, a tuition freeze means greater financial stability for me and my family, a family responsible for putting through three kids through college. My older brother graduated from the University of Minnesota 2 years ago. I will graduate next spring, and my younger brother will be transferring to the Twin Cities campus this fall. Coming from a middle-income family from greater Minnesota, I can tell you that paying for college for three children can oftentimes be a family affair. I am eligible for the Minnesota State Grant, receive scholarships. My parents commit several thousand dollars each year to our education through federal loans. Even with all this, my brother and I still have to take out loans, work full-time at a summer job, and usually have to find a job during the school year. And when tuition rises, even by 3%, it can make a semester even more stressful for me and my parents, who I can promise you are two of Minnesota's best. While my brother and I try to figure out how to make ends meet. For us, a tuition increase will mean more loans, student debt, and larger payments after graduation for both my family and I. This situation is not unique to the Olson family from Moorhead, Minnesota, but to families all across the state who face rising tuition. Thank you, and I will gladly take any questions.
Senator Eakin, any comments? He's your senator, I think.
Oh, I know.
I'm proud to have constituents like this person. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Wallstein. We're happy to have Ms. Wallstein back with us after maternity leave. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Amy Wallstein. I'm the Director of Education and Workforce Development for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I just wanted to share a couple quick thoughts on the conference committee's work. We strongly encourage adoption of the Senate position relative to the state grant program. We feel it's important to adjust the eligibility requirements rather than reduce funding to ensure access for a greater number of students to the state grant program. Another program that we encourage you to support is the Earn While You Learn dual training program. We've been pleased to work with Senator Monoff on that for several years. Through this program, we feel that more employers and industries will be able to implement dual training and custom training programs, which will help businesses become more actively involved in finding and training the workforce. We also support several of the completion and transfer provisions in the various versions of the language. The House language relating to remedial courses for students who have college-ready ACT scores. The Senate language regarding co-requisite courses, something we also strongly encourage. And also the Senate language regarding using or requiring MinSQ to use proven strategies to ensure that students graduate on time. We also are strong supporters of the performance benchmarks that are included in this bill. And finally, just a quick word on the attainment goals language. We support the language that was developed around the attainment goals, which was the product of the North Star Summit that we had last fall. It's clear that our future workforce needs some level of post-secondary. We feel that working towards a common state goal of 70% by 2025 will make that focus clear and have everyone working together towards that. So with that, any questions?
Very good.
Thank you.
So Mr.
Anderson from the Washington Center. I was surprised to see you here this morning. I hadn't realized you were in town, so if you could just briefly speak.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair. Yes, I am in town. I came to speak to some of the House members, and I was invited to testify, so it's a pleasure to be back here. I'm David Anderson, Senior Vice President of Government and Strategic Initiatives at the Washington Center for Internships and Academic Seminars in Washington, D.C. If the $50,000 appropriation is included in the final bill, this will enable 12 to 14 students from public and private universities in Minnesota to come to Washington for a transformational experience. In fact, the mission of the Washington Center is to provide a transformational experience that fosters professional achievement, leadership, and civic engagement. There's three main parts of the student experience. The students intern 4 days a week. We have close to 1,700 students who come from 45 states and over 30 countries to Washington each year. So they basically work in an internship 4 days a week. Could be on Capitol Hill, could be in a federal agency, a nonprofit, or a for-profit. They then take one of approximately 30 academic classes that our adjunct faculty teaches. Then they have Friday leadership activities, special speakers, the Alan Simpson, Carmenetta speaker series, and all kinds of reflective activities. And that might include such organizations as the Paralyzed Veterans Association or homeless citizens. Now, I always tell people, as I've traveled around the country and I have raised money from 23 states in the last 10 years, I come from academia, so I taught at 6 universities, so higher education is part of my DNA. There's really two main values that we're trying to promote, which I told to the Senate committee when I testified. There's the value that you're funding about $6,000 to a public university student and about $3,000 to a private university. There's the value that this provides to the students. You will have a big impact on 12 to 14 students. I mean, in Ohio, it's 100 students. It depends on the appropriation. Each student, each life, like the young man who's just sitting here, you'll have a big impact on them. We have 52,000 alums, and many of them say the program changed their life. That's the first kind of value. But the second kind of value is the value that is provided to the communities to which the students return. So the Washington Center is driven to bring students from all over the world to Washington to intern and have a fantastic civic engagement leadership experience, and then for them to go back to Ohio and Florida and Russia and China and Illinois, and to give back. They give back political capital, civic capital, business capital. Skills they've developed,
the email addresses they have, the connections, they come back, and someone may work at the USDA in Washington and then come back and end up in their career will be in the USDA in northern Minnesota. So, yes, you're trying to help 12 to 14 students individually. That value is there, but you're trying to bring back a value to your state. So there's the return on investment. And finally, I would say we do work with Minnesota public and private universities now. St. Mary's, Augsburg, Winona, St. Cloud. But we're bringing on average 3 students a year from your state because there's no funding coming from the state. And it's pretty much private university students who can afford it. So if you provided funding, we could go up to 15 students or 14 students a year. And at some later date, maybe we'd increase it higher. But without the funding, the public university students, it's practically a non-starter. And even the private university students could use a few more dollars of your commitment. So I graciously request your support of this item.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, next we have Victor Sandler. Dr. Sandler.
Good morning. My name is
Vic Sandler. I've been practicing medicine for 40 years. I'm certified in internal medicine, geriatric medicine, and hospice and palliative medicine. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you this morning. Senators and representatives, I don't care whether you're Democrats or Republicans, you want the same thing as everybody else. You want to live to be, say, 90 years old, healthy and happy life, no illnesses, and pass away in your sleep after having a wonderful dinner with your, surrounded by your children and grandchildren. It's what everybody wants. The bad news is that's not what's going to happen. For 90% of you, we're going to be afflicted with chronic illnesses, serious illnesses such as heart disease and Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, cancer. We're going to have a period of physical decline that will last for years and often mental decline before we die. There's one type of doctor that excels in caring for complex needs of frail elderly. It's called a geriatrician. Geriatric medicine became a specialty in 1988. Right now, there's only one in 100 Minnesota physicians that's a geriatrician. That's one geriatrician for every 5,000 Minnesotans over age 65. The University of Minnesota produces no geriatricians. It has no division of geriatric medicine. It spends 2 days of medical school in 4 years on geriatric medicine. The whole state of Minnesota produces three geriatricians a year, two at Mayo and one at Hennepin County Medical Center. And that's despite the fact that the University of Minnesota is a land-grant university, as you all know, and has a responsibility to service the needs of the citizens of Minnesota. They had a division of geriatric medicine 15 years ago, which it disbanded for financial reasons. In the university's legislative request for this biennium, there is $2 million requested to begin to right that wrong and resume caring for and training to care for elderly Minnesotans. It's not enough, but it's a start. I hope you'll consider giving more and hold the university's feet to the fire until it fulfills its responsibility to you and your parents, your families, and all Minnesotans. Senators, I'm a geriatrician. I'll be 65 this year. We need to train more geriatricians to fill my shoes and those of other geriatricians soon to retire. This type of care provided only, not only by doctors, but also nurses, social workers, and pharmacists, provides the safest and highest quality care for frail, older citizens of Minnesota. Many studies also show that it saves millions, if not billions, of dollars in health care costs on unwanted medical treatments for frail, elderly Minnesotans.
Well, Dr. Sandler, thank you very much for being here. And so half the members here are House members, so they're representatives, not senators. I just want to make
sure. Sorry.
That's all right. Dr. Sandler approached me, he's a constituent of mine, and shared his frustration about the situation at the University of Minnesota. And then I learned that actually in the request the university made for support of the med school, there is a proposed amount to be for this type of training. And so I thought it was worthwhile to hear the importance of this question, Representative Nornes.
Not a question exactly, a comment. I'd like that number move from 90 to at least 100. So we're a little more optimistic here.
I like the way you think. So any other questions? Thank you very much for coming.
I just made one final comment. You may wonder why we're not going directly to the University of Minnesota, the medical school. We have for 7 years a group of geriatricians from the community and some from the faculty have been trying to change this for the last 7 years, and we hope that now that President Kaler and his request has asked for $2 million to correct this, we hope you'll fund this and even go further. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I know you've all come to give testimony, particularly those who are just next on the agenda. But the House is convening at 10, and they've been asked to be there on time, so we are going to have to reconvene to the call of the chair. And so I would ask members to stay attuned, and those who want to testify, we will make sure that everyone gets to testify. So you'll be asked back, and I thank you all for attending this morning. With that, committee is in recess. Workforce Development, Higher Education, Workforce Development Committee is now in order. We will begin with where we left off. Just in case interested people want to know, we believe we have a target, but we're not going to announce it publicly until we've all heard the same number at the same time, because you know how those things go. So. What did you say, Senator Miller?
Madam Chair, so we're going to wait for Twitter to report?
That's the announcement. The Senate floor is the best way to get your news. So if you have any doubt, check Twitter. Yes.
I don't Twitter. Mr. Chair, we'll fill you in.
All right, so back to our agenda. Paula Hoffman and Maureen Ramirez, if they would like to approach the table. Together, I believe. She's not here. And I will first, before they begin, acknowledge publicly the work of both Paula and Maureen for being our strong leaders of the North Star Summit. So thank you for your coordination. Thank you for your leadership. Thank you for your visionary tenacity in accomplishing that. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Pahul Hoffman. I'm Council Director for the Citizens League. I am happy to be here to offer testimony in support of higher education attainment goals for Minnesota. With me is Maureen Ramirez, Policy and Research Director for the As Ms. Hegard and Chair Bonoff alluded earlier, the Citizens League convened a series of three workshops with the Office of Higher Education last fall. The purpose of the workgroups was to discuss the issues around higher ed affordability in order to generate goals for improving retention and completion. It was during this time that the Citizens League and fellow sponsors came together to convene the North Star Summit, as mentioned earlier, to gauge interest in and consensus around setting higher ed attainment goals for Minnesota. As facilitators for the workshops, we knew that eventually we would need to roll up these goals to form a larger strategy. So the timing could not have been better when the idea of setting attainment goals was proposed. We were not alone in thinking that attainment goals would be important or necessary. Of the 325 people who participated in the summit on December 8th last year, including college and university presidents, administrators, faculty members, student organizations, counselors, nonprofit, and business leaders, nearly 100% of the attendees indicated during their live polling that it was important that Minnesota set higher ed attainment goals. After the summit, we followed up with all attendees through email and through our post-summit survey, those who both attended the higher ed workshops as well as the summit. And again, there was broad support for statewide post-secondary attainment goals. While the specifics of what should be included in the attainment goals will and should be debated,
excuse me, can our staff do something about the sound, please? So, sounds like we're going to have a technical break. Okay. Okay, so pull cell phones away from the microphones and push it maybe away from you.
I think it's primarily just feedback from that mic. So I think maybe just move it and then again tip it down a little bit.
Okay.
That's fine.
While specifics of what should be included in attainment goals will and should be debated, absent even the notion of having attainment goals, I worry members that these conversations will not take place in a meaningful way. When we hear about the gaps and what must be done to close them, we are immediately overwhelmed by the enormity of the statement and the issues. The problem is big, so many of us are working hard to come up with possible solutions. Sometimes we address them in complementary ways, sometimes we come at them completely different. But if there were statewide attainment goals, at least we would all know we were heading in the same direction. With that, I thank you for your time. I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hott.
There's barely a speaker someplace nearby. There you go.
It's haunted.
Good, I'll go first.
That our provision is going to be negotiated in the higher ed bill. Did you know that? Oh. Did you know that, Representative O'Neill?
I just found out. I think they
are. Yeah, I think they are.
They're recording. They are picking up levels. I turned them back on in here. If it starts buzzing, I'm not really sure.
Another
is it this one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We could just okay.
Maybe I can turn it down.
That mic seems to be a lot hotter than the ones we have up here. So if there's a control on it. hot is a technical term.
Well, let's remember that Representative Nornes used to own a radio station, so I think we're going to turn this over to Representative Nornes, the technical assistance.
I'm going to go try to find another mic.
My thought is she just held the mic.
Yeah.
And you might avoid the feedback too.
Oh, really? Okay.
You're right.
Do you want to just pick up the mic? Why don't we just try this?
Yeah, is it working? It's recording now.
It's borderline.
It's going to be hard for me to testify without moving.
I think you're good. Is Sam okay?
Move back a little.
Back a little bit? Okay. I know everyone's listening, so I will go ahead with my testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, my name is Maureen Ramirez. I'm Policy and Research Director at Growth and Justice. I'm here this afternoon to speak in favor of the legislature creating statewide attainment goals for higher education. Happy to be here with Prabhu Hoffman and the Citizens League, with whom we worked on the North Star Summit. Attainment goals for the state are not a new idea for us or for the nation. As you heard from Ms. Hegard from the Lumina Foundation this morning, 26 states now have articulated a statewide attainment goal, either set by the governor, the legislature, or the college or university system. At Growth and Justice, we have a long history of supporting the statewide goal dating back to our Smart Investments in Minnesota Students report from 2007, where we stated that in order to meet the demand for future workers, that an increase in the rate of students completing higher education was needed, and that the state should set the goal and then devise a strategy to get there. That's why the subtitle of the report is a research-based investment proposal. I'm not here to suggest a specific goal, but to say that having a goal for the whole state will provide a vision, a direction for the higher ed institutions and all the providers of post-secondary training, including DEED and even private employers. An overarching goal for the state would serve to unify a disjointed workforce development system that operates and produces graduates and trained workers somewhat in isolation from each other. I think our goal would contribute to more collaboration across higher education and post-secondary training and across K-12 and adult basic education. Each institution could see its role in the creation of the workforce for the entire state. The goal would be beneficial in guiding decisions to support specific initiatives aimed at building system capacity and using resources more efficiently and effectively. This will be good for students, this will be good for the state. This will be good for the legislature and the institutions themselves as they measure their contribution to the overall goal and differentiate themselves in the marketplace. The statewide goal will guide policy and investment decisions at the state and institutional levels. In terms of measurement, the new reporting requirements in DEED that were passed last session are a good start to getting baseline data for training programs. They're disaggregating by race over there. The SLEDS database is another start on data collection, and as our methods continue to get better, we should have increased confidence in our ability to track our outcomes in the aggregate, but also disaggregate by race and income. And this kind of specificity would ensure that we're reducing education attainment gaps at the same time as addressing a broader overarching vision. That concludes my testimony. We support the motion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And as you may know, we are considering doing some kind of changing to the language as it's currently in the bill because we've gotten feedback that it's not clear. And so as we get to more granular details, we go through the bill, we'll talk about that. And I understand that you've given important input towards that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for the members? Thank you. Next, we have Roger Ahrens.
Madam Chair,
can we take a break too?
stand.
Gene's not here. I wonder if whoever's testifying could sit at Gene's spot and use that microphone.
Let's see if Roger has a comment about
that. Yeah, let's do that. Yeah. So, Mr. Aronson, if you could sit at this across from Gene and flip the mic around. He's fine.
Plug the other.
So can you unplug that mic? Thanks all for your patience. That's why we're going to do some reforms at the Capitol, some renovations. So we have high-tech sound systems.
So this is working now, right?
Yeah.
Well, Madam Chair and Sharon Arnes, and especially when this is all played back, it's radio, so none of this is going to show up on any of it.
We don't want any mysterious gaps in this.
There you go.
High-end gate.
My name is Roger Arnson, and I represent College Possible, and we want to thank both chairs for the opportunity to just have a few minutes to mention our particular proposal. This was heard in both the House and Senate. Representative Erdahl authored the bill in the House, and Senators Cohen and Bonnoff authored the bill in the Senate. This is a very important program that has very high results. You've heard all about that. As the chair pointed out, you're coming close to a target, and we just, as everyone that is part of the community coming forward, just hope that you're able to find some room in that target for this very valuable program. And you know we're going to come back, and to the extent that there is some room, we're going to demonstrate some very positive results for you for the accountability provisions that have been put in here as well, Madam Chair. And so again, we thank that you for the opportunity to come and remind you of our valuable program at this point. Okay? Answer any questions you might have, Madam Chair.
Any questions for Mr. Aronson? There's some confusion around whether or not lobbyists are allowed to be at the table, but we have you at the end. You're not really touching it, so I think we're okay.
Madam Chair, actually, I would say that in several of the smaller conference committee rooms through the years, this has happened in this particular fashion. Okay. In the Capitol as well. So I would say this is more time spent with audiovisual than I've ever seen in my 30-plus years here, but it has happened before, Madam Chair. So I didn't touch the table.
And thank you for being here, and thanks for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other comments, questions from Mr. Aronson? Okay, great. Okay, next we've got Sarah Strawn on behalf of MSP Wynn.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Sarah Strong-Belisle. I'm with Victor, and today I'm representing MSP Wynn. MSP Wynn is a philanthropic collaborative who is made up of funders of career pathway programs, and career pathway programs have a key partnership with MNSCU institutions, so we're very interested in ways to improve our state's post-secondary performance. I want to thank both chairs and the committee members for your work on the bill, especially on the provisions that focus on student success. We appreciate that both the House and Senate bills include the timely college completion strategies proposed by Representative Norton and Senator Carla Nelson, especially the provisions regarding co-requisite remediation. In our view, the additional reporting requirements that are carried in the Senate bill are a key component, and we urge you to include those that language in the conference committee report. We have national data that tells us only 1 in 10 remedial students graduate, but we don't have solid data on remedial student success in Minnesota because reporting is not currently required. The first and foremost important step to improving remediation is to require transparent reporting on those outcomes. And I'm going to leave it at that. So thank you very much.
And a question for you, Ms. Strong. So when you're talking about the specific Senate reporting language, are you talking about the Claussen provisions?
It's the Complete College America provisions. Specifically, we have some reporting requirements that the Senate language has that the House language does not.
Gotcha.
Although we will say that the provisions carried by Senator Claussen, as well as your paper, the Senate's paper,
performance goals focused around remediation. We all think, MSP Win thinks those are really great steps as well. We just hope that whatever you do on remediation, you'll include some basic reporting so that way we can compare traditional remediation outcomes to any other reform remediation or co-requisite or whatever the institutions choose to do.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Cynthia Christ.
Chair Bonoff, Chair Nornis, but it's a low chair or a high table or something. My name is Cindy Christ. I represent MACTA, the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. And we include 20 private colleges, the 7 state universities, and all 4 campuses in the University of Minnesota. As such, there are many things in this bill that obviously are of interest to all of our members. But legislatively, we focus primarily on issues that are of concern to all of them. So I'm only speaking this afternoon about the Teacher Shortage Loan Forgiveness Program provision, which is contained in the House bill. The appropriation is on page 11 of the side-by-side, and the policy language is on pages 39 to 40. But I would remind the senators here at the table that you passed out of committee, as did state and local government, Senator Jensen's bill, Senate File 759, which was essentially the same. So clearly this is a concept you support. The governor's supplemental or revised E-12 budget bill also contained funding for what he called MinTeach, which is also a teacher shortage loan forgiveness program. So it seems that this is an idea that has the support of all three branches needed to cross the Senate finish line, or the session finish line. So we'd just like you to strongly consider retaining it in the bill that you negotiate. We think that this bill, by providing loan forgiveness, really offers opportunities, especially if it's continued over time, to help encourage candidates to select teacher preparation, teaching as a career. We think it has the potential to help those in programs see their way to finishing them, knowing that there's a chance that their loans will be forgiven, and to encourage and support the retention of practicing classroom teachers by getting loan forgiveness. And finally, we think it's important because we know when we look at the data that a shortage of teachers is not the only thing causing the hiring problems facing many school districts. Working conditions, perception of teaching as a career, low pay among the others, as well as the challenges of staffing small school districts. So in that respect, we think particularly perhaps in small rural districts, this could be very helpful for them to attract teachers who might otherwise be unwilling or feel unable to take a position with somewhat lower pay, knowing that in return for teaching in that district, their loans will be forgiven. So we'd really encourage you, when you negotiate your final bill, to retain the provisions that are in the House bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, next we have Tim McDevitt.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Senators, and members of the House. After seeing the smiling faces this morning, when Mr. Pogemiller's testimony was brief, I will try and emulate that this afternoon. My name is Tim McDevitt, and I'm an alumnus of the University of Minnesota educational system. After graduating from Duluth East High School, I spent my first 2 years at Mesabi State Junior College in Virginia, Minnesota. I then transferred to UMD, where I completed my Bachelor of Accounting, and after completing my MBA at the Carlson School of Management in the Twin Cities, I have continued my association with the university by volunteering and participating in the alumni associations of both UMD and the University of Minnesota. I attended an event at the Northrop Auditorium last week where a panel of 6 past and present university presidents spoke to a number of issues, including the main campus's relationship to other levels of higher education here in Minnesota, with its 5.3 million residents. I concur with the statement of Niels Hassemal that the community colleges, state and private colleges outside the Twin Cities are all contributors to the overall university's mission as a land-grant institution. I feel my experience in the three institutions all uniquely contributed to my education here in Minnesota. I believe a balanced funding approach, including the medical school's investment, would prove beneficial to our future citizens. Thank you, committee members. I'll answer any questions that someone might have.
Mr. McDevitt, I really appreciated that you called just out of the blue as somebody who cares and asked for an opportunity to testify. It makes a difference. We want to hear from our citizens. So any other comments?
My only comment, my son graduated from Carlson Business College as well. So you got that in common. But he made the mistake of moving to Illinois.
Oh. Let's move on back.
Thank you. So not on the list, but a few who have asked to testify after the list was put together. First, we have Paul Sirk-Fennick, Minnesota Private College Council.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Sirk-Fennick, President of the Minnesota Private College Council. Thank you for this opportunity to ask you one more time to make the Minnesota State Grad Program a priority in your final decisions here in the next few days. The grant program is an efficient and sound investment because it provides tuition relief for the students with the greatest financial need at all institutions, public and private. In other words, it makes the biggest difference because it focuses resources on the students who face the biggest financial barriers. Need-based aid helps increase graduation rates, it reduces student debt, and it improves learning outcomes because it allows students to spend just a little more time studying by reducing the pressure to work excessive hours during the school year. The state grant gives lower and middle income students the ability to choose the college that fits them best. And students can choose to attend the college that fits them and their goals and aspirations well, they're more likely to graduate on time and to have a successful educational experience. In the history of the grant program, both in good times of surplus and in difficult times of deficit, legislators of both parties have always made it a priority to help keep college affordable for students by investing in the state grant program. We know you have a final bill to assemble and you'll have to strike a fair balance doing that. We just ask that balance include a reasonable new investment in the state grant program that allows for an increase in the tuition cap and the living expense part of the formula as well. Our college has already served a lot of low-income students and low- and middle-income students, and we'd like to serve more. An investment in the state grant program will make other colleges an option for more students, will give them a good education, and will help them graduate on time, and that will generate a good return, not just for those students, but for the state as well. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Sirk-Fennick?
Thank you.
Thank you. Kenneth Ebon.
Good afternoon, Chair Bonoff, members of the committee. I want to thank you for providing me with the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Kenneth Ebon. I am the Program Director for Students for Education Reform in Minnesota. I'm here on behalf of our students and members who had school and other things going on, so they couldn't make it today. For those of you that don't know, we're a nonprofit organization that organizes college students and community members around issues in the education system based off of our members' experiences. Today, I'm here to discuss our Reimagine Remedial campaign addressing the use of remedial courses in the Minsky system. Before I begin, I'd like to thank the members of the Higher Education Committees in both the House and the Senate. We had many productive conversations all through session with many members of both committees, and we'd really like to, we really do appreciate your time and effort and all that you've done to work with us. We're also thankful to see that the use of co-referendum courses were mentioned in both the House and the Senate version of the Omnibus Bill. However, today, on behalf of our students and members, I would like to support the Senate language regarding the timely completion of programs for the Minsky system from line 41.23 to 42.32 on page R43, proposed by Senator Claassen. While we truly believe the intentions of the current form of developmental education were good, it has become a barrier for students across the state of Minnesota. Nearly 25% of Minnesota college students in 2013 needed to take a course that added to their student debt but did not help them get any closer to graduation. Minnesota's taxpayers cannot continue to see their tax dollars go towards a remediation system that continues to put college students further in debt and has become a barrier for completion. While we are all aware of the achievement gap in the K-12 system, remediation in higher ed system only exacerbates the problem. The most recent data from the SLED's data reports says that 30% of African-American students and 39% of Latino students need to take remedial courses, while 19% of white students are taking remedial courses. While all those numbers are way too high, we are putting our students of color who already beat the odds in a K-12 education experience at risk again to not complete their post-secondary degree or certificate, because nationally less than 10% of students in two-year colleges complete their programs within 3 years, and only 35% of students at four-year institutions complete their degrees in 6 years. Something needs to change. The use of co-requisite courses can save students time and money, while also showing students who want to support you in completing your degree or certificate and realizing your dreams. Many of our students have shared with you all of the emotional burden remedial courses have put on them by making them feel like they don't belong in our post-secondary institutions. While we know this won't solve every problem in education, this is something we can do right now to support our college students, not only financially, but in the classroom as well. Finally, I'd like to thank Minsky for working with us on this. We know nearly all the remedial courses taken in the state are provided through the Minsky system, and they have been helpful in identifying the weaknesses of our language, and we appreciate their help in strengthening the language. Specific positions that we are supporting in this bill are, we have mentioned in this letter, on the second page, it's in bold, and so if you want to take a look at that. But in closing, I'd like to make two additional recommendations to the Senate language that isn't currently included. First, we love all the reporting language in the Senate bill. It helps us get a better picture of what is happening with remedial courses across the state. However, we recommend that you include the disaggregation of data by institution so we can get a better sense of how institutions are addressing the issues of remedial courses. Second, I would recommend adding the language to have this start in the school year of 2016-2017 so Minsky institutions have adequate time to learn, design, and plan their co-requisite programs accordingly to ensure the best results for our students. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I will now stand for questions.
Mr. Abon, so I just want to make sure that we're all tracking. So the language that you're speaking of is on R43?
Correct.
Line, starting with line 41.23.
Chair Bonoff, that is correct, yes.
And then your specific recommendations are to disaggregate the data in the reporting, and then to delay the start date of the provisions to 2016-2017.
Yes. The disaggregation of data is included in the letter that I mentioned. The delayed start date is not included yet.
Thank you. Good. Any other questions from Mr. Avon?
Yes, it's approved
by Minsky. Mr. Avon, have you discussed your recommendations with Minsky, and do they, have they heard that?
Chair Bonner, members of the committee, no, I have not discussed the provisions with Minsky. I know that in Senate language, or Senate file 352, we did discuss the delayed start of 2016-2017. As far as the disaggregation of data by institution, we have not discussed that with them thus far.
Thank you. Okay. Very good. I think we have one more who requested it, and that was Matthew Roderick. Roderick.
Roderick is fine.
Thank you.
Thank you. I brought some visual aids with me.
Introduce yourself
to
the record.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Matthew Roderick, and I'm here to again discuss the spinal cord injury traumatic brain injury grant program. First off, and I'll try to be brief, I'm a little statistical envy this morning from seeing some of the spreadsheets and charts, etc., that were talked about, so I went home and grabbed some from home. A couple years ago, when we approached this initiative, I did a lot of work to investigate with information from Minnesota Department of Health and also from the National Spinal Cord Injury Statistical Center to gather data. And so I've got that here for you. But I wanted to start first with the number of people in the state with SCI TBI, 118,500. And that's relatively the population of the urban-defined Duluth that have lived with an impairment or disability from spinal cord injury, traumatic brain injury. With a focus on spinal cord injury, this chart represents the distribution of injury. So you can be injured in your spine from your cervical all the way down to your sacrum, and that corresponds to cost. And that cost in the state of Minnesota is $560 million. And again, those numbers are from NDH, National Spinal Cord Institution Injury Statistical Center, and they're also reflecting approximately 60% of people with spinal cord injury are unemployed. So that's pretty expensive for a small population. I just wanted to remind you folks of all that. And when you see these two charts here, or these two columns, one, the blue represents the cost of that injury. Our assertion is that given the advances that are happening currently in spinal cord injury, which we are hoping to bring to Minnesota, bring Minnesota into that fold, the strategies currently used to provide innovative treatments for spinal cord injury would reflect roughly a 30% improvement in function. That corresponds to a shift in level of injury. For instance, my son is a C5 quad, cannot use his hands. Moving a segment or two down the spinal cord would give him function and give him more independence and translate into significant cost savings, which are highlighted in the last graph, which at that conservative estimate, did I just flip that wrong?
Upside down.
$126 million savings to the state with some of those advances to come here in Minnesota. And as you all know, I've talked about those advances and where they are and what the ones that are bubbling up currently right now in the state of Minnesota that this funding would make accessible to our community. And lastly, statistics mean some things. But the reason why I'm here is because of that young man. My advocacy started about 6 years ago because this young man was injured. And this is him at a recent gig at the Triple Rock. He writes music and sings with a band. And I'd invite you all to come a week from Friday to see them play again for a couple of hundred people at the Triple Rock. They're a fabulous band. He's moving on with his life as the best as he's able. He was a phenomenal piano player. And I would love to see him use his body a little bit more. Even if it's that 30%, he could sing a little stronger, a little louder, keep his breath a little better. So I'd ask you again, please remember us. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Rodriguez, you know, it was funny because you were talking about the cost savings to the budget. And, of course, as policymakers, we have to think about that. But as you were speaking, I was thinking about the mobility. And I was thinking about the quality of life for those who you're speaking for. And so I'm glad you showed us your son's picture because that's really what had us put it in the Senate bill. It was interesting when you guys brought this forward, two of the people who were the speakers that day were from my district.
Yes.
And one in particular, Jenny Taylor, was in my daughter's class, and so when she was injured. So it's near and dear to my heart.
If Jenny could get off her vent.
That would be something.
That's the kind of change we're talking about.
Yeah, thank you.
To be able to breathe on her own would be enormous.
It would. Yeah. So thank you.
Thank you.
So that's who's requested. Everybody who has requested to speak has now come before the conference committee. Is there anybody else who has not made a request who would like to take this opportunity?
I feel as though the legislative process has been fulfilled. If you would all just wait one moment while I confirm with my co-chair, just for a moment. We'll put this up in front.
Secret
So I did say that we weren't going to announce the number until every leader was saying it at the same time with the same words. And so we have a picture of three leaders' signature. And so that means that we will announce the target. And so the target is $166 million over base. And then the only thing that has been formally agreed to, although I happen to know there were some informal agreements, but the formal agreement is that of that, $30 million will go towards the University of Minnesota Med School. So that is the deal. And now, conferees, stay tuned to your emails, and we'll get together in short time, knowing that the goal is really to have this bill wrapped up by the end of tomorrow. So, any questions?
Madam Chair, are you anticipating a meeting today?
Senator Claussen, I'm not anticipating that we would get back as a conference committee tonight. We may have meetings, between the Senate, between the House. Is that your
thinking? That's what we plan to do.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you.
But that's why you'd still need to be. Okay, very good. So with that, the conference committee stands adjourned. Thanks for your attendance.